Okay, so welcome everyone to Poetry. It's really, really good to see you all this evening, and especially welcome to Fiona, who I'll introduce properly in a minute. So what we're doing here at Poetry is we have between four and six Poetry events a year. We focus a whole evening on one poet, an outstanding poet in the UK, and we focus on their life and work. Fiona's already been here once, so we're going to be particularly focusing on Fiona's work this time. The reason we have Poetry East here at the London Buddhist Centre is one of the things we're doing here, we're trying to, I mean, you could say the fundamental thing we're doing here at the London Buddhist Centre is we're trying to help people live out their potential, discover their potential. We're trying to help people flourish their life. From a Buddhist point of view, the Buddha figure behind me here represents that life at its most flourished. The figure on the shrine here represents our potential, our human potential, at its most perfected. You know? So to manifest that potential, we need to, first of all, can't start to notice ourselves with mindfulness. We need to start to feel for other people. So we have meditations that help you connect with other people, feel for other people, empathise with other people. And one of the things we want to do is we want to help people discover and animate their imagination. And one of the great ways to discover and animate your imagination is through poetry. So that's why we're having Poetry East, and that's why we've invited Fiona tonight. The Buddhist vision of imagination is it starts with awareness of your body, so otherwise it tends to sort of float off into fantasy. So we're going to start with a short meditation just to tune ourselves in, just to settle down so that we're ready for the reading later on. So if you'd like to just sit in your chair with your feet flat on the ground. And then when you're ready, closing your eyes. And as soon as you close your eyes, start to notice, if you can, how you are just now. So you might be feeling okay or not okay, relaxed or tense, energetic or tired. And the first thing we need to do is really just take that on board. Just be aware of how we are just now, how the day has left us. Try to notice especially how you are in your body. We spend so much time in our mind, but how are we in our body just now? And our body might be comfortable or uncomfortable, but all we need to do now is just feel the body, however it is. And then just start to notice that your body is breathing. You don't need to try to breathe. You've been breathing quite happily up to now. See if you can just feel your body breathing. If your body feels uncomfortable, try breathing into that discomfort. Consciously directing your breath into any discomfort. And then broadening out your awareness to include your whole body, sitting here just now. And whatever sensations you can feel in your body just now. And just let them be there. And then just noticing the weight of your body on the chair or the cushions, the support of the chair, the cushions, your feet on the floor. And then when you're ready, opening your eyes and coming out of the meditation. Okay. So we always ask our guest poet to recommend two poems that have influenced her work. And so first of all, Yon of Arch is going to read Edward Thomas's poem, Lights Out.
Lights Out. I have come to the borders of sleep, the unfathomable deep forest where all must lose their way, however straight or winding, soon or late. They cannot choose. Many a road and track that since the dawn's first crack up to the forest brink deceived the travellers, suddenly now blurs, and in they sink. Here love ends. Despair, ambition ends. All pleasure and all trouble, although most sweet or bitter, here ends, in sleep that is sweeter than tasks most noble. There is not any book or face of dearest look that I would not turn from now. To go into the unknown, I must enter and leave alone, I know not how. The tall forest towers. Its cloudy foliage lowers ahead, shelf above shelf. Its silence I hear and obey, that I may lose my way and myself.
Thank you, Yana Lacha. And now Kim will read. I can never pronounce. How do you pronounce
it? In Chetanya.
By.
Chetanya Miwash.
There we go.
In Chetanya. You were my beginning, and again I am with you. Here, where I learned the four quarters of the globe. Below, behind the trees, the river's quarter. To the back, behind the buildings, the quarter of the forest. To the right, the quarter of the holy ford. To the left, the quarter of the smithy and the ferry. Wherever I wandered, through whatever continents, my face was always turned to the river. Feeling in my mouth the taste and the scent of the rose-white flesh of Calamnus. Hearing old pagan songs of harvesters returning from the fields, while the sun on quiet evenings was dying out behind the hills. In the greenery gone wild, I could still locate the place of an arbour where you forced me to draw my first awkward letters. And I would try to escape to my hideouts, for I was certain that I would never learn how to write. I did not expect, either, to learn that though bones fall into dust and dozens of years pass, there is still the same presence. That we could, as we do, live in the realm of eternal mirrors, working our way at the same time through unmowed grasses. I ran out in the summer, drawn into the voices of the birds, and I returned. But between the two moments, I created my work. Even though it was so difficult to pull up the stick of N so it joined the stick of U, or to dare building a bridge between R and Z. I kept a reed-like pen holder and dipped its nib in the ink. A wandering scribe with an ink pot at his belt. Now I think one's work stands in the stead of happiness and becomes twisted by horror and pity. Yet the spirit of this place must be contained in my work, just as it contained in you who were led by it since childhood. Garlands of oak leaves, the Ave bell calling for the May service. I wanted to be good and not to walk among the sinners. But now when I try to remember how it was, there is only a pit, and it's so dark I cannot understand a thing. All we know is that sin exists and punishment exists, whatever philosophers would like us to believe. If only my work were of use to people and more weight than my evil. You alone, wise and just, would know how to calm me, explaining that I did as much as I could, that the gates of the black garden closes. Peace. Peace. What is finished is finished.
Thank you very much, Ken. Thank you. Thank you. So, welcome here. I need you to be wired up.
You're not in your way. Caught on your arm or anything.
So I'm delighted to welcome Fiona Sampson to Poetry Eve to launch her new collection, Coles Hill, which is a Poetry Society recommendation. She's published 19 books, most recently her new collection, Coles Hill, and more recently, Beyond the Lyric, A Map of Contemporary British Poetry. Fiona has won the Newdigate Prize and has been shortlisted for both the Forward and the T.S. Eliot Prize. She received a Writers Award from the Arts Council of England and Wales, and a Cholmondeley Award. She's been published in more than 30 languages, and her 10 books in translation, one of which I put in brackets, I won't even try and pronounce.
Zlatan-Priston.
That one. was awarded, what was the prize called?
Zlatan-Priston.
There we go, that one. So useful to have Fiona. Fiona gave Newcastle, I can do that one, Newcastle Poetry Lectures under the title Music Lessons and was editor of Poetry Review for 7 years. She is a regular broadsheet reviewer and a distinguished writer at the University of Kingston. She is the editor of a new international English language quarterly magazine called Poem. Tim Liardet from PN Review simply calls her a major poet. Fiona Sampson. So really good to have you here
it's
again.
It's lovely to be back. Yeah,
very nice indeed. So firstly, I want to ask you, as usual, about your choice of poets. So firstly, the Edward Thomas.
Well, I'm ambivalent about Edward Thomas. I'm ambivalent about what we know about the kind of person he was. But I am moved by the way most of the poems that we know him by were written under the, they are in a sense war poems, they were written under the, you know, under the shadow of the knowledge that he was going to be going to war. I mean, he signed up before he joined up. So I think that they are nearly all about us being haunted by death. And I chose this poem because I've worked with it a lot. When I used to work in hospice, I found that it's a very useful poem for allowing people to be apparently talking about sleep and really they're talking about death. And it also gives a sense of easeful death, but also something to do with the loneliness of death, you know. Each must lose their way, you know, whether you want to or not. Everyone goes into the dark forest alone, and it's not the, you know, Dante in the middle of life's journey, I entered a dark forest. It's sort of us walking off stage in a way. And I also love it for another completely different, a technical reason, which is I love what he does with form. I love his light touch with rhyme and the way it enjams all the way through, so it's quite hard to read, isn't it? Because you want to, also because he has old-fashioned punctuation, he tends to put a comma at the end of a line as if you should stop there. But the meaning rushes through over the line, but the comma, and for your ear, the rhyme mark that, and I just love that. I find that form very pleasurable too. So the kind of huge meaning and the containment of a really elegant form, I really love it.
I mean, he's also becoming, as a poet, many contemporary poets seem to look back to Thomas now. It's
He's fashionable,
he's,
isn't he?
He's fashionable,
yes,
though,
he is.
Isn't he?
Well, I think that's, I mean, that's another reason why I'm ambivalent about him, because he is, our love of Edward Thomas is part of our resistance to modernism, and of course I think modernism was a tremendously good thing, and, you know, made us all question our relationship to form and to society, which I also think is very important, and I feel that had we had a little more modernism in Britain, we might have had got rid of some of our class system and so on. So I'm an ardent modernist, and I do know that, you know, the love of the Georgians is a kind of resistance, a kind of sense of, look, there's a line of continuity from Hardy to Edward Thomas to Larkin to, who, you know, Alan Jenkins. I mean, there's kind of a tremendous slippage into cosiness, which I resist, so although I admire all those poets. So, yeah.
And the Milworth?
In the Miosh, because his poems are full of beauty, first of all, and because I quite like the way when you read a poem in translation, you have a sense of through a glass darkly. You have a sense, it's the opposite of the Thomases, so you have a sense that there was probably a beautiful, elegant, oral object beforehand in Polish. I mean, by the time you get to Facing the River, he's in his 80s, he's won the Nobel Prize, he's co-translating his work into English, and he's beginning to write in English, so there isn't that same sense. But of course, the English he writes, well, not of course, the English he writes is a kind of California free verse, which sounds like Robert Hass, who was his great translator.
Oh, yeah, cool.
So, you know, and he did the opposite thing from Brodsky, who said, well, I'm a great formalist. Every language must be tractable to form in exactly the same way as Russian. And the fact that English is really hard to rhyme in and because it comes from lots of different roots, well, I'm going to override that and force my poems in English and my translations in English into strict form, which of course doesn't really work for our ear. So Miłosz, who was a friend of Brodsky's, and who was very generous to Brodsky when he got out, when he got to America, because obviously they were fellow exiles, does the opposite and is very interesting. But I also think he's very interesting because he didn't live apart from history. I mean, not as though that was his choice, but, you know, he in his late poems often talk about the duty to bear witness, the duty to write about people who were abolished by the war, because he was in Warsaw during the siege, during the Warsaw Uprising. And he was the first to write about the Warsaw Ghetto. At the time, there are some poems like Campo di Fiori, where he writes about the carousel and the ghetto on the other side of the wall. And nobody else did that for, you know, decades. So he was true to his mission in the sense that he did bear witness. It wasn't just reportage, it was transformed into, well, into things of great beauty and things of great resonance and things of questioning. And so that he didn't set himself up as an authority in a way that, for example, a war reporter has. He brought it back to a kind of shared humanity and made himself small in comparison to history. So, you know, it's a very large sweep of things. But, and luckily, and perhaps aptly, he lived to be very, very old and continued to write. I mean, in this, he called this book Facing the River because he thought he was facing the River Styx. But, I mean, there are something like another 5 collections after this. And they are great. You know, they are. There's no falling away of the poems. So I just think he's an extraordinary poet. For me, he is, after Eliot, the poet of the 20th century. And also, I like this poem because it has that piece at the end, which is very like Shanti in Eliot, isn't it? And the Return to the Garden. I mean, he can't not have read the Eliot. He can't not have read Bernard.
And your Central Europe is very important to you. Central European culture, Central European poetry. You've translated Jan Kepinski's work, for instance, and many other. Could you say something about? I think you've even said that Central Europe feels like your cultural centre of gravity.
Yes.
I think you're quite unusual in that way.
Yes, I am.
I can't think of another contemporary poet who feels that so strongly.
Well, not another contemporary British poet.
Right, yeah. Probably the same.
Oh, that's really normal, yeah.
Fairly ordinary in Poland, yeah. But we're not in Poland, are we?
No, that's true. I agree. True. Well, I mean, it's because I used to be a musician. That's something that I'm now much more relaxed about admitting. I used to be very... you know, when you've done something and change in sort of midlife, I mean fairly early life, but still you change from one world to another, you don't want to be an ex, in my case, violinist, you want to be a now poet. So I used to keep the world very discreet, but increasingly I see them as overlapping. You mean, I'm very interested in, you know, line in verse.
Mm.
And the thing about a classical music education is that the centre of your conceptual world, the centre of the tradition that you're inheriting, is between Vienna and Budapest.
Mm.
So, you know, obviously I grew up like you, you know, in the Cold War, but I never had the sense that, oh yes, Europe is, you know, the Costa del Sol and Paris. Of course it is. But I always had this easterly, this latterly conception of it.
Mm.
And then I had various jobs to do with literary translation, and as a result of them, I find a kind of recognition or naturalness in about my way of going on over there, as if somehow I'd absorbed through my musical life a Central European way of going on. I mean, you know, the idea that you are a poet and that you are also what is loosely called an intellectual, you know, a writer and intellectual hyphenated, is completely normal in Central Europe. I mean, it's banal. You wouldn't be anything else, almost.
Right.
Whereas here it's revolutionary, controversial, it must mean you're not serious about the verse, it must mean you're somehow a kind of poetry class traitor, you know, you're failing to be a poet because you dare to think. There's just nothing like that in Central Europe. I mean, quite the reverse. And I think one of the things for me that was very difficult about changing for music was I found that what I am, there was no place for it. I couldn't find what it is that I am for a long time because there is no place for it in our culture, because we don't have that. But the moment I looked through the kind of, as it were, train window at Central Europe, and indeed Europe in general, I found, no, I'm not odd. I'm completely normal. This is just a normal, integrated way of going on, where you write poems, but you are also fascinated by other poetry, so you might do something else, like translate, or indeed post Poetry East, or, you know, you have a thickening up around your practice.
Mm.
That is to do with curiosity, but it's also to do with kind of care and conscientiousness, you know, these things. That was a very long way away from your question.
So I want, just moving on, what I want to do, as I said, you know, at the start just now, is I want to focus on your work. We've talked about your life a lot. You've had more life since then, haven't you? But let's focus on you. The first thing I want to ask you about is the new poetry magazine, the English language poetry magazine, Poem. Slightly shocking title, I think.
Yes, it is. Well, I thought there were two ways one could go with the title. You either call it something really oblique, you know, like The Stinging Fly, to take a safe because Irish example. Or you call it something, you know, very, does what it says on the tin, like poetry, or poetry review, indeed. And I went for the latter, because I think if you go for the former, it makes it sound like a kind of coterie, or a kind of, it sounds too whimsical. It doesn't sound accountable enough. It also wasn't my idea, actually. Another poet gave me the title, and I resisted it for a while, and then I suddenly, sort of, my mind flipped, and I thought it was a completely brilliant title.
It's amazing, it hasn't been used, isn't it?
Yes, yes. And, exactly.
And why did you create it, and is it, why is it needed?
It's needed, I think, for several reasons, but a main reason is because we're not very internationalist. I mean, we, and also, not only are we not looking outward, but nobody's listening to us. You know, you go to North America, and I don't know if there are any North Americans in the room, but, you know, there's a kind of almost imperial attitude. As if, I mean, last year I judged the Griffin Prizes, which are terrific, wonderful Canadian institution, which, I mean, if you must have prizes, you know, which we can talk about under another heading, but if you must have prizes, the Griffins are great because they're Canadian. They have one sort of national prize every year for Canada, and then they have one for the whole English-speaking, I mean, English publishing world. In other words, they bridge the Atlantic trough. And so there's always a Canadian and American from the States judge, and usually a Brit, or anyway somewhere else in the world, and I was a Brit last year, and it was really striking that these very accomplished North Americans had not heard of any of our, they hadn't heard of Sean O'Brien, they hadn't heard of David Carson, they hadn't heard of anybody. The only people, so, and very interesting, the only people that they sort of picked out of the box who were Brits were people who spent time in the States, people who we don't think of as people, okay, people whose work doesn't particularly excite me, and probably doesn't excite many other people here either, but because they've been in the States, these North Americans had heard of them, and partly that is, I mean, all sorts of things have made that happen, but they are cultural structures, you know, it's not an existential truth that if you live in Toronto or San Francisco, you are incapable of reading something published in London. But lots of things need to happen, like it needs to be also published in the States. You need to get hold of a copy. You know, there need to be reviews, so you've heard about it. Mm. And that kind of exchange isn't going on at the moment. Mm. It also doesn't help, I think, that the British Council has changed its mission, rather, so that it's more about business and language, instead of always being like the Goethe Institute or the Institut Français, sending out British writers. Mm. So we're inaudible everywhere, really. Mm. And that's no good. There's no... It's not only just sad for us, because we have really wonderful poetry in the moment. It's such a well-kept secret. Mm. It's also the kind of law of diminishing returns, because there's no dialogue. We're not engaging. Yeah. So for all those reasons, I think there needs to be an Anglophone magazine which is kind of scrupulous and excited by poetry and is open, completely open. Anybody can submit, but which is very internationalist.
Mm.
Mm. So that's what Perm is trying to be.
Mm. Oh, good. I'll do it next time.
Yes.
Can you say that?
With a fabulous essay and poem.
Yeah. Let's move on. I mean, in your work, carrying on about Perm for a minute, and sort of linking with, you say that today, you talk about today's extraordinary renaissance in British poetry. Mm. I wonder whether you can say more about that, because in Beyond the Lyric, you're slightly more muted in some way.
I hope not. I'm trying to say that, really, in a way. I mean, I'm trying to say... I think there's so much good stuff going on, and I think there are barriers here, too, to hearing it. And some of those have to do with a tradition, in a sense, of different, let's say, publishers and magazines having a particular house style. Now, that's very normal. I mean, all publishers have a house style, all editors love particular kinds of things. But there's a tendency for particular poets, all particular poets, to be presented as, this is what you should, this is the model, this is it, rather than, this is one it. Mm. It happens, there's another fabulous it over here.
Mm.
And I'm really of that dispensation, again, because I was a musician, and when you're a musician, you know, a performer, you have to be able to get lots of different kinds of music. And if you can't, the shortcoming's in you. Mm, it's not course, in the music.
Yeah.
So I've always felt like that as a reader and as an editor and critic, that I have to be able to get different kinds of poetry in their projects. And the shortcoming is in me when I don't. And I think that one of the other reasons why, if somebody sort of come across a bit of poetry but not very much, they're not welcomed in, is because... because of this sense of, you're faced with one kind of poetry and you don't realise that there are lots of other kinds.
Mm.
Also, it's a kind of arts journalist narrative of, you know, there must always be a new generation with a new way of going on, and everybody, totally, in this moment is writing in this new way of going on. But of course, we're not like that at the moment. We're not, you know, surfing the wave of modernism. We are in a really, in a sense, postmodern moment, but only in the sense that we've fractured into lots of different ways of writing poetry.
Mm.
And a lot of really interesting ways of writing poetry. We should be listening to each other and reading each other.
And it seems that that's what's really sort of been behind Beyond the Lyric.
Mm. I wanted to make a map. I wanted to say... I thought of myself when I started being into poetry and how long it took me to find out about all sorts of poets who are really very, very good and have a body of work and, in fact, are very established.
Mm.
And... if you're enthusiastic about something, you want to share it, don't you?
Yes,
you don't sort of think it's only of interest to three other people, you can't see why it's not of interest to everybody.
Yes, that's right. I mean, a friend of mine was saying that after reading it, he hadn't realised how much he needed a map.
Mm.
You know, that before then you were sort of exploring in the dark, but... It is very definitely a map, isn't it?
Yes, and it is a map which is trying to talk about presence rather than absence. In other words, to say, so-and-so does this. For example, let's say, since we're talking about, I mentioned Sean O'Brien already, let's say, for example, Sean O'Brien is doing a kind of really thoughtful, authoritative, often politically or socially engaged, but not always, sometimes just personally engaged, writing, which has the ghost of iambic pentameter, you know, the meter of blank verse of Shakespeare, that really authoritative meter within it. In fact, it often is pure blank verse, isn't it?
Yeah.
And that's a poetic project. It has to do with authority, not to do with power or arrogance, but has to do with a kind of public speaking are speaking to us and for us as a society. And that one should look at what he is doing, which is that, rather than saying, oh, I don't like him because he doesn't do what this other poet over here does. For example, let's say, be John Burnside and have a long elastic line in a completely different music and a dreamlike shifting subjectivity where you often don't know what's going on. I mean, you could say, you know, they shouldn't hate each other or should hate each other's work. So I try to talk about presence rather than absence, the presence of the pentameter in O'Brien, rather than the absence of elasticity, and the presence of elasticity in Burnside, rather than the absence of authority. You know,
so. I think Hugo Williams once said that you seem to like everything.
Yes, but that's a really Hugo, because it's very Hugo. And of course, what's interesting about that is that Hugo, like many poets of his generation, is a product of a very combative house style way of going on. He's not combative, he's a very generous soul, but he's a product of the New Review and The Review and Ian Hamilton, and this sense of you've got to write in a very narrow kind of way, feelingful, tiny little verses, and anything else, the barbarians at the gate. You know, you've got to write in only this way. I think confusing taste and excellence. I think taste and excellence are different things.
Yeah, of course.
You know, I think that there are people who write appalling verse in pentameter and appalling post-Burnside verse, and there are people who write wonderfully. And so yes.
Yeah. Let's start to move on to Coles Hill. You know, I've got obviously a lot of questions about Coles Hill. Firstly, I thought it might be good if you introduce Coles Hill as a place. You've lived there for 14 years. It's part of the spirit of the book. I don't think it's the whole spirit of the book, let's hear a little bit about the place.
Coles Hill, I ended up living there by accident because I had a job at Stephen Spender Memorial Trust, and I was living in West Wales in a very vertical landscape. I mean, above the snow line in the Cambrian Mountains.
It's the other side of your arm. I think that will...
Better?
This way. Lift. Arm lift. There you go. That's it.
I'll try and sit still.
No, don't sit down. That's fine. Now you don't need to.
I was living on the side of a mountain, and then I had to move. I was told the furthest I could be from London was Oxfordshire, and Coles Hill is 1 mile. Well, in fact, not. My house is 1 mile inside Oxfordshire. Coles Hill sits on the border. The River Coal is the border with Wiltshire, and Gloucestershire is only 2 miles away. So it's kind of nowhere, which is great because it's a corner. It's forgotten in a way. It's enormously interesting to me because I live there, but it's also interesting in lots of ways because it's in the Doomsday Book, it has a church, it's now very sort of involved in the slow food movement, we have a lot of organic food activists, we have wind turbines and that sort of thing, but it was a model village built for the tenants working for the big house. Big house burnt down when it was given to the National Trust, so it's just this model village. And it's in Cobbett and so on. It's a product of the agricultural revolution. So it's a real paradigm of what's happened in farming life in Britain over the centuries, and it's still a farming village. It's not a commuter village or a kind of Arga-Saga gentrified village because it's largely rented. And I was horrified by how flat it was when I moved there. But by now, I've become very, attached to it. To my surprise, I tried to move earlier this year and found that I didn't want to.
So, it's a nice discovery, isn't it?
Yes, it is, yes.
And at the same time, you know, you called it a psychogeography. And reading it, there's a strong sense through the collection, and in many ways the collection reads as an extended sequence. When I was reading it, I felt there's a strong sense of it emerging from an inner landscape, actually rather painful inner landscape, to a shared and neighbourly landscape.
Good.
You know, was that your vision for the book? What was your vision for the book?
Well, my vision actually is a very sort of odd genesis, really, because the commission was to write a book about my village, and I think my editor had in mind a slightly a gift book. How I've disappointed her. You know, I think she thought of a kind of Shepherd's Calendar, a kind of, you know, 21st century, or worst, John Clare, you know, a kind of very accessible. And I did try and do that because, you know, it's nice to be asked to do something. But I couldn't for several reasons. One is that I'm just no good at photograph poetry. I'm not a describer. I'm in the rules of descriptions, but I'm not interested in that, in poetry. Another thing is I found that I can't write about real people, because...
They are difficult, aren't they?
Well, it's not that. It's that we want to tidy up and make it all about their best selves all nice. And that's no good for verse. It hasn't got that kind of chip of ice in it that you need for a poem.
Yeah.
So there are kind of people, but not really, in the book. Mm. And the third reason was that because I live there, it is my psychogeography. It is where I'm happy and it is where I'm sad. And it is the view I look out on when I'm battling with something. So all those things stop me producing a Shepherd's Calendar. Mm. And
I don't think you were going to be the Shepherd's Calendar, Dave.
I know. But
I mean, it seems to me, your darkest collection so far.
Which is a hotly contested title, actually, isn't it?
Is it? Right, yeah.
I think they're all quite dark.
Mm. true. I mean,
yes,
one of the key words in one of the poem, The Changes, you talk about guilt, rumour,
yes,
and grief, and you talk about them as being the necessary meal. You talk about your neighbour death, your neighbour you call fear. One sense on it is called death threat.
Mm.
I don't want to pry, but...
but you are.
You know what I'm going to. That's the English way of prying, isn't it?
Yes,
I don't want to pry. We're not in Poland now. What's going on?
What's going on?
What's going on? Come on, cards on the table.
Well, several things. One is that... One is a really practical thing, which is that although I try and write first thing in the morning, actually I tend to write the poems that I don't abandon, the poems that become something, in bed at night, when I've got insomnia, or so they're in that kind of cusp, that kind of dream time. So there's simply a lot of night and...
There is, yeah.
Yes, because I don't know how to write in poems at that time, I think. Then... all my books have death in them.
Yeah.
All my books have a man with a knife in them, and all my books have grief for a partner who's dying in them.
Mm, that's true.
Because he's taking a long time to die.
Mm.
And the man with the knife because it never goes away, you know. So it's just that both those elements come in different forms in each book.
Mm.
People never... pick up on them. People never think I'm being autobiographical.
Mm.
They think I'm being autobiographical when I talk about, I don't know, walking the dog or driving, and indeed I am. But people always think I'm less autobiographical than I am, partly because I don't write straightforwardly confessional verse. So, one of the reasons the death threat mattered to me so much was because, and indeed to the Met, was because there was a sense that it might be the same guy coming back, or it might just be a loony in the poetry world. You know, one couldn't know which. So I always feel the man with the knife is in the wings. I always feel he's waiting, you know. And I'm also always waiting for Sasha to die. So those are my left and my right, in a sense. And then there's this little lighted spot in the middle where I have a working life and a kind of normal life, and, you know. But they cast long shadows, both of them. And the shadows don't get shorter. I mean, when you're young, you think, and something bad happens, you think that it will go away, and it never goes away. It becomes part of your narrative of yourself. And all writers return to their material over and over. And although I don't want to repeat myself, I don't want to write the book, same book each time, I think my changes are often in form rather than in content. Yeah.
Well, I'm just thinking, as you're talking, going back to Common Prayer, the hospital poems in that.
Exactly.
There's an echo of that in a very different form. In Coleshill, isn't there?
Yes, there is. I think that Hawthorne Milk in Coleshill is the most close to the plunge in Common Prayer of all. But interestingly, the plunge, which was a very autobiographical one about Sasha's illness, was a commission. It was the Verb, and they wanted a hospital poem, because I used to work a lot in hospitals, and I found I couldn't write about hospitals without writing about him, and it was the first time I wrote about him.
Mm.
So, no, it's not the first time I wrote about him. He's also in The Distance Between Us.
I mean, again, you know, there is, you've in a way you explained some of this, but there is so much darkness, in literal darkness, dreams, sleeping, waking, nightmares.
Well, it's also no secret, I was extremely unhappy in 2011. I mean, it was a terrible time. And, you know, if you are going through a terrible time and you can't talk about it, of course it goes into your work, in a sort of transformed, what was it Mio said about, you know, it gets... Now I think one's work stands in the stead of happiness and becomes twisted by horror and pity. I mean, it's really true. I don't mean to say that I'm Miwash or to stand on that pedestal or anything, but it is true. You can't... If you control... If every word that you put into a poem is consciously selected and is a rational choice... The poem won't yet be alive, will it?
No.
It's got to have that little sort of halo of the unconscious. Which I don't mean means that you have to be really honest, but or direct. But at the same time, you can't lie.
No.
It's a very odd sort of space between truth and...
I mean, sort of taking you in away from that for a moment, one of the other distinctive things about Coles Hill, of course, is this sort of theme of sonnets that runs all the way through it, 14 sonnets, obviously. get it? 14 line poems, 14 sonnets. Again, actually, starting with dreams and horror, the incubus is back, grown fat on lack, you say in the first sonnet. And then this lovely sort of rather quiet and rather lovely epiphany at the end of neighbourliness in the final sonnet. Can you say something about sonnet? Your approach to sonnet has always been... like you've written sonnets in syllabics.
Yes.
Sometimes people say you're sonnet-like. Some people here won't know really what a sonnet is. People often use it, and nobody ever tells you what it is.
Yes.
And so what is it, and how come yours are?
Well, sonnets are 14-line poems, which traditionally are love poems. Sonnet means a little song. So traditionally they're in form, which used to be an iambic pentameter. And what I particularly like about sonnets is that they are an out and back question and answer. Traditionally they have 8 lines in which you propose your problem and 6 lines in which you resolve them. So the great sonnets include sort of metaphysical sonnets, so, you know, a Christian metaphysical sonnet would be, and indeed is, you know, the more you hurt me, God, the better it is for me. Why do you hurt me so much, God? Ah, it's because it's good for me. So a kind of, you know, conflict resolution. Or, you know, shall I compare thee to summer's day? It goes on and on and on and on about, for 8 lines about, why she's like a summer's day. And then closure with a kind of resolution, but it's really about you. And, you know, as long as this lives, as long as this poem goes on, you'll live. So there's an out and return. And I like that very much because I like having more than one thing in a poem. I like things pulling on each other in everybody's poems, you know, when I'm reading them. Just like I said about the Thomas, this very moving line of thought, but then form containing it. That's about the makerliness. But I often like a poem which looks like it's about an everyday, a normal day in summer, but really is about somebody's gone away or something, you know. I like pairings. So I like this form, which has such tradition that, for example, if you write a poem, a sonnet about hate, for example, death threat, what you're saying, you're bringing all the resonance, and what you're really saying is hate is as intimate as love. You know, death is as intimate as love. So, for all those reasons, I like them. And I can't help but make them my own, because I can't write pentameter. Whenever I do, I just become really boring. I mean, no, I'm boring anyway, but I mean, I just become leaden. Because obviously my breath is shorter. You know, I don't have big lungs, and obviously I'm a 4-stress girl, woman. I can't really get beyond the 4-stress line, and I like the 4-stress line anyway because it's ballad and it's medieval carol, and those forms really speak to me and refresh. So I tend to have a 4-stress line in sonnets too, and I certainly do in these.
Yeah. I mean, reading it, you know, it really struck me that you, I don't know whether this is your intention, but it felt like the whole book is an extended sonnet, because it seems to have a turn. It seems to have a going out and coming back, if you put it. I was looking again, I reckon it's between pages 48 and 51. But the 11th sonnet, where there's an allusion, for instance, to Edward Thomas.
Yes.
And after that, it seems to me there's this gradual change. In Night Music, you talk about fear not cancelled ever, but shadow struck by happiness.
Mm.
That fear not cancelled ever, but shadow struck by happiness feels like a description of the book in some ways. And it feels like the shadow struck by happiness feels like there's a turn towards that, a turn towards others, a turn towards neighbourliness. It's dedicated to good neighbours. Mm. I don't know whether that was somewhere in your mind, a sort of sonnet-like shape, even to the book.
Yes. Well, I don't... Yes, I mean, I hope so. But to be honest, that's to do with the ordering. Mm. I didn't write them in that order. Because even when you're unhappy, you have good days and bad days.
Yes.
You think, oh, right, this is over, I'm surfacing. Oh, no, I'm not. But I've always done that. That's to say, written a body of poems, and then when it's getting near book time, you know, put them out on the floor and shuffle them and found how they speak to each other and, you know, made a structure overall. I do that with every issue of a magazine, actually. I like the overall arch. And it also untangles what is otherwise a very blurry story. You know, all of it on the cusp, whereas if you kind of go into the dark and then come out again... And I am an optimist, you know, I suppose. I have a sonnet soul, you know, I do believe in the turn towards the light, yes.
I mean, you get this moment, don't you? I think one of the things that really struck me was this moment in Durantris in School Lane, where we suddenly get the word grace.
Yes.
I was really struck by that. Suddenly, after so long, we get this word grace, and I couldn't help then putting that next to the word grief and guilt, which are key words earlier on.
Yes.
It feels like that, just that word turns us into another thing. So obviously part of that, well, I think part of the turn that I saw was a movement towards the local, the neighbourly, a movement towards the light, the literal light, even though it's shadow struck, and a movement, you know, obviously towards faith. Religious faith.
That's true,
in
actually.
The word grace.
Yes, you know. Not that I've become religious, but actually there's nothing like... I mean, you really understand when times are hard why religion was so powerful when people had really awful lives, you know, nasty Buddhists in short, as they say, about, you know, life in Anglo-Saxon medieval times. You know, not only that you wish there could be some... I think it's wanting to find some light to turn towards, but I think there's also there's something quite important to me about truth, and I think when everywhere the truth is not being told, you need there to be some stable, there needs to be somewhere where, you know, the truth is seen, God is not mocked. And I mean, I don't say this as a Christian, I haven't become Christian again, but you want... I mean, when people are behaving badly, often they behave badly because they are being flexible with themselves and with their morals. You know, they're giving themselves the benefit of the doubt, aren't they? And they sort of say things, whether or not directly to you, like, well, that's what, you know, that's your truth. But I'm a moral realist. I don't think that good and bad and truth are opinions. I mean, sometimes they are. I mean, one gets things wrong.
Yes,
but I think there are facts. You know, I do think it's bad to murder somebody. I think that's a fact. I don't think it's my opinion. I think it's a fact. And I think that about other things, too. So you can see why, when times are hard, people want there to be a suprahuman realm which witnesses truth and which can be, it's like the meter rule in Paris, can be the original of truth to measure against. So I think that's why the faith stuff went on.
I mean, there's a poem that ends, Christ, what is the use of all this grief? And then this wonderful last line. It's almost like the collection, in terms of faith, moves from that to this wonderful last line, if you're not dead, you're doing all right.
Yes.
and this lovely kind of poem ostensibly about plumbing.
Yes.
Which,
well, actually, that all too is autobiographical, because actually I developed a tremor. I developed and I was really frightened. I thought I'd really got some horrible illness, and I went to various neurologists who did lots of tests, and in the end just said, yes, you have got a terrible tremor, but what's happened is that something has switched on your essential tremor. We all have a tremor. And something has switched it on. Well, I wonder what that could be. Not stressed by anything. As you can see, I don't have a tremor anymore. I have a little bit sometimes. For example, you'll see when I read the death threats on it, I start shaking. And my voice goes shaky. So I became very interested in it. And then I had a sense of, you know, like Brownian motion, the whole world is, you know, atoms are jiggling about the whole time. The whole world is shimmering and tremoring and... you know, often when you see animals in the wild, you know, you're not quite sure if you've seen them or not, because the camouflage is good. It's like, what I say, it's like the earth moving across itself. And that too is like a tremor. It's just like a movement in the environment. But actually, of course, it's a sentient being who's busy running away from you. But that sense of instability, but everything sort of standing in its spot and jiggling is... I became very interested in that, obviously. Hasn't gone away.
So one last point that in my reading, you've got this sort of sonnet-like collection that turns towards the light, that turns towards a yearning for faith, at least a yearning for
For truth.
Yes, for truth. But then you've got this interesting sort of coda and prelude. And again, in the coda, we come back to this beautiful papery dark, as you call it. We come back to moth, rat, and ghost. We come back to darkness, we come back to sleep. It made me wonder whether, you know, our little life is rounded with a sleep.
Yes.
Whether that's what you were... That somehow you're saying, even though there's darkness and light, there is this sleep either side.
Yes. Well, I certainly wanted it to be sort of once upon a timey. And not once upon a time in a sort of Disney way. But once upon a time in a... I mean, actually, what it came from was... a Hungarian novelist friend of mine sent me a photo of the wooden villa he's restoring outside Budapest, and he got it really cheaply because it was sort of falling down, and he was in love with it. And he sent me photos of it, and you could see it was beautiful, but my goodness, it looked like a haunted house. And I had a tremendous sense. I'm very fascinated by buildings because they seem like stories ready to be told, you know, and I had a real sense of this house as kind of opening into a story, which sounds terribly twee, I know. But so I wanted to preface and close, close down that world. I wanted, in a way, I wanted to maybe to put a sort of parish boundary around Coleshill.
And that's what it sort of does, and it sort of also rounds it with this sleep. Just finally, what... I wonder, you know, going back to this reading of it being a sonnet in itself, what has putting this collection done for you, as it were? Because it looks like a collection that starts dark and gets lighter, that reaches out to other. Do you think it's helped you in that journey? Do you think poetry, I suppose this is for us, you know, do you think poetry can help us to move from a dark place where the incubus is back, feeding on lack, all the way to if you're not dead, you're doing all right.
Which is not very far, if you think about it.
No, it's not that far. But
frankly.
It actually it comes across rather more. Anyway, we'll read it later, probably.
I don't think that writing poetry makes anything better. But it is remission from your life. It is a stretch sideways of your life. You know, so that those... givens, which can be so cruel and so limiting, you know, it's existentialism, really, isn't it? That nevertheless, you can choose. The mind is free to, in every situation, to make its own version, to go off sideways, to add something to what's going on. So I think writing is remission, but I certainly think reading poetry can be very... can be your, you know, your good companion, your, you know. And... I mean, that's something from working in hospitals. It's a strong sense of poetry as specially human, specially flexible, so specially accessible to you when things are difficult. and a kind of compassion in that flexibility. You know, poetry is not like a scientific diagnosis.
Mm.
In a sense, it's all doubts and uncertainties. Poetry doesn't know. But it just gives you possibility. Just opens up. Yeah, just opens everything up a little bit. So I'd say reading, but not writing.
That's a great place to finish. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Tea, and then Fiona.